reacting to external demands or instruction rather than in ways determined by his own interests and energies and power. He says we may admire what he does, but we despise what he is. For Humboldt, then, man is born to inquire and create. And when a man or a child chooses to inquire or create out of his own free choice, then he becomes in his own terms an artist rather than a tool of production or a well-trained parent.
Hello and welcome to the 53rd episode of the Diet Soap Podcast. It is Thursday, April 15th, Tax Day, and I'm Douglas Lane. The guest this week is Bud Hopkins, a prominent UFO and abduction researcher and an abstract expressionist painter. This week we discuss his art and the history of avant-garde art, and next week we'll delve into the realm of UFOs. So this week's episode is entitled The Collage Aesthetic, and you'll just have to listen next week to find out what I come up with for a title to sum up the abduction phenomena. I have quite a number of people to thank this week. Last week I offered to send a copy of my newest short story, Noam Chomsky in the Time Box, as a thank you gift for a donation of any size, and Adam CB, Aaron G., Dan F., Blue Wave Technology, Philip P., Jamie O., Greg J., Stephen E., Jock D., Brian W., James M., Jennifer M., Daniel R., and Kevin D. all contributed, and I hope that everyone had fun reading the story. I want to thank all 14 of you for helping out. You've made me question the need for traditional publishers in this internet age. I'm going to continue to offer that short story to people who contribute. However, I'm not going to continue with PayPal donations. Not for the next 3 months. I've started a Kickstarter project, and Kickstarter is an online funding platform for creative projects. I'm going to write a radical self-help book that revolves around harvesting fruits and other edible plants from trees and bushes that are already growing in my neighborhood. There are a variety of urban gleaning projects going on already in Portland, so the nice thing about this project is that very quickly my definition of self will be transformed from an individual I into a we. So that's one radical element to this self-help book. I'll tell you more about the Kickstarter project at the end of this podcast, but up front I'll just say that the PayPal button will be coming down and a link to the Kickstarter project is going to go up. So if you make a pledge to the Kickstarter project of a dollar or more, you'll be able to get my short story, Noam Chomsky in the Time Box, regardless of whether this Kickstarter project is ultimately successful. It was great fun talking to Bud Hopkins. We discussed the works of Jackson Pollock, Robert Motherwell, Mark Rothko, and many other artists, not the least of which would be Bud Hopkins himself. Okay, so right now, you're listening to Eric Griswold's Concerto for Prepared Piano and Percussion, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to Bud Hopkins talk about the collage aesthetic. Bud Hopkins, you are a central figure in ufology and abduction research, but you are also a painter and sculptor of note. You're an abstract expressionist, and in your book, Art, Life, and UFOs, you write about your relationships with other painters, such as Mark Rothko, Franz Klein, Robert Motherwell, and Jackson Pollock. Your works are in the permanent collections of the Whitney Museum, the Guggenheim Museum, and the Museum of Modern Art. You are also the founder of the Intruders Foundation, a nonprofit organization which seeks to provide sympathetic help to people who report abduction experiences. You also research the abduction phenomenon and try to educate the public on the subject. Along with your recent memoir, you've written several books, including Missing Time, Intruders, and Witnessed. So do you have anything you want to add to or correct about that bio?
Of course, there are four books that on the UFO subject, the fourth being called Sight Unseen. The other thing is, when I was writing writing about artists that I'd had relationships with to some extent in the Abstract Expressionist days. Jackson Pollock is included in the book because I had had a number of incidents with him, although I don't want to, it's thought that I knew him well or anything like that. When I came to New York, he was already on his way out physically and emotionally and everything, and even artistically.
But you had a much closer relationship with Mark Rothko, right?
And well, Rothko and Klein and Motherwell. I knew Motherwell the best because I had a long time with him. We were for 20 years in the same gallery on Cape Cod. But and of course, poor Rothko and Klein died early on in terms of my life. So my relationships were truncated, you might say.
These are big influences on you, maybe Motherwell most of all.
Yeah. Well, Motherwell was really important to me because he was the painter really kind of pulled me into abstract expressionism and into the whole idea of being an artist as an extremely serious life goal and the mixture of ethics and aesthetics, which he stressed, I thought was something that I've carried through in my life, too. He was very important influence.
I'm interested in the avant-garde tradition as an ethical and political tradition. And I'm kind of interested to learn from you how the abstract expressionists fit with the avant-garde as I know it, which is that the avant-garde tradition is tied to radical movements on the left. The neo-impressionists, for example, were mostly anarchists or socialists. Dada is obviously political. It sprang out of World War I. And it was an attempt to reject bourgeois society because they saw that the Western culture itself is culpable for the horrors of the war. Surrealism was revolutionary. Breton saw the movement as part of a larger communist revolutionary project. But abstract expressionism is largely seen as kind of an apolitical avant-garde movement. How does working with the avant-garde tradition, what does that mean to you?
Well, first, I'd like to correct something in your question. The basic thing is that most of the painters in all of these periods had a political position, but they were not people you would describe as being politically active in any way. In the Impressionist and actually Neo-Impressionist, you've got especially Pizarro, who was an anarchist and so on. But Pizarro was also a Jew who was not born in France, so he must have felt that he was very accurately probably marginalized and downtrodden by bourgeois society, which was anti-Semitic and everything else. And the Surrealists really weren't involved in the communist movement, although André Breton was, who was the leader. But he was essentially a writer, and the painters themselves, Miro, Max Ernst, and so on, they were not particularly Dali. They were not particularly political. And I don't think really that painters have a history of being politically active. They might say they have a political position, most of them would, but I doubt that the Surrealists were any different, really, in a way, the painters, from the Abstract Expressionists. Each went their own way, and the Abstract Expressionists were a group of intense personalities, you might say, and probably none of them really accepted the majority of the others as sort of cohorts and anything other than a kind of an aesthetic revolution, but they're not going to think, I mean, Rothko's not somebody who is going to be involved with, say, Hans Hofmann or Franz Klein very much. And I think politically, each one just had their own position. As far as I remember, everybody was, of course, at least left, liberal, but nobody was particularly active. When we got to the later times, the Vietnam War and so forth, things changed enormously, but by that time, abstract expressionism was sort of on its last legs. So as far as I'm concerned, from how it affected me, I went my own way. I was a liberal traditionally in the abstract expressionist years. We used to sit around and bash Eisenhower and Nixon and so forth. But we weren't active. And, you know, the funny thing is that I haven't known that many artists or even writers who I thought were really politically active. Everyone had their own position and feelings, and they were practically always on the left.
Right. One of the things about an avant-garde approach to art and politics is that it tries to kind of transcend the maybe the traditional categorizations of life. So, like, maybe your politics are is actually in your art, you know?
Well, I think that's true. I think that, excuse me, the Impressionists, who were not particularly active, as I say, other than Pizarro. The Impressionists felt that they were doing revolutionary painting. I mean, that they felt they were certainly undermining, you know, bourgeois values and everything else.
Right. Yeah. And I think the same is true maybe of Surrealist painters. And Breton, you know, he would start excluding people when they crossed political lines. I think Dali was thrown out for a painting he did of Lenin.
Yeah, well, Dali was, I think, always a kind of a problem as much as he was an asset to the Surrealists.
Right, yeah.
But that was because Surrealism had a leader, quote-unquote, in Breton. I mean, he really ran things. He was the king who made decisions. He was in and who was out. And abstract expressionism never had anything like that. Actually, even Cubism, you know, these movements didn't really have a leader. Surrealism was a very different situation. Actually, Futurism was too with Marinetti, but that's another story. But at any rate, those are all marginal to my concerns. That's the past. And I think right now, of course, painting has gone into a very marginal place in the way art is being shown and discussed because of, and incidentally, not to change the subject, but reading about your book, and I should have written the title. What's the title again?
Well, the title for my short story collection was Last Week's Apocalypse.
Yeah, right. That's right. The Apocalypse. Well, I was reading that, and I was thinking that a writer who I knew slightly and dedicated a painting to years ago was Donald Barthelme. And I'm sure that Barthelme is somebody you look upon with some respect.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Now this gets into the whole idea of collage and the collage aesthetic, as I wrote about.
Yeah.
And this is extremely important to me as an idea that that what happened, certainly in modernism in the 20th century and began in the 19th, was a kind of split in what the artists were doing at the same, that they were doing a couple of things at the same time, which might have been seen as disparate. I mean, for instance, what the Impressionists began to separate the way they put the paint on and how they treated paint. They separated that from the object that was being represented, the landscape or whatever. So you could say painting is going in one direction, which is getting very loose and free and expressive on its own. And representation is still there, but it's sort of in a slight battle with the means that are being used to represent it. And I think when you get into Cubism and all of this, later, these later movements, I think, have their in a certain sense, their basis in film, which is the ultimate collage, because there's no fixed anything with film. So what would happen is artists would put together really disparate material and feel it was okay. I mean, it's all right to be disparate. And I when I wrote about this, I mentioned Renoir as a kind of an example of an old version of an artist's work, because the image he was painting, say, a lovely nude, and the means he used to represent her were all one. He used beautiful color, beautiful brushstrokes, and so forth. But when you get into Cubism and Surrealism and all the 20th century movements, you're really seeing things are that there's a kind of war between the means and the subject matter, so-called. And I think this is absolutely true of everything that is called modernism. I mean, when you think about, say, Eliot's poem "The Wasteland," I mean, you lose any sense that there's the poetic voice, that there's one particular voice dominating, as if he or she is telling a story of feelings or whatever in poetry. So I think we're living in this crazy world of disparate things, and it in that sense, it's not for me at all unlikely that I would be doing two sort of radically different things. I'd do a UFO investigation and painting.
The burial of the dead. April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us, coming over the Starnberger See with a shower of rain. We stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. Bin gar keine Russin, stamm aus Litauen, echt Deutsch. And when we were children, staying at the Archduke's, my cousin's, he took me out on a sled and I was frightened. He said, Marie, Marie, hold on tight. And down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free. I read much of the night and go south in the winter. What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images where the sun beats. And the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow at morning striding behind you, or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. Frisch weht der Wind der Heimat zu, mein irisch Kind, wo weilest du? You gave me hyacinths first a year ago. They called me the hyacinth girl. Yet, when we came back late from the hyacinth garden, your arms full and your hair wet, I could not speak and my eyes failed. I was neither living nor dead, and I knew nothing.
It's what struck me while you were describing the separation between the means employed to create a painting and the what is being represented as the means of painting, the way you apply the brushstroke or the means employed changed, the subject matter shifted as well, so that rather than being, especially with your kind of art, rather than being focused outwardly on the world, like the Impressionists were, it became more and more interiorized, more about painting and more about what was going on inside the artist.
Right, absolutely. And of course, also, you can't have what's going on inside the artist completely separate from the outside world. So it's going to be represented in some way, even by its non-presence. You know, there's going to be, it's, for instance, in Rothko, thing that I wrote about him had to do partly with the idea that those big, to some people, blank rectangles floating there with a strange emotional, resonance, one color against another, that Rothko had told a friend about having heard these stories about the graves that were being dug, had to be dug when the pogroms took place in Russia when he was a little kid. He remembered hearing about it. And he said, I've been painting those graves, that grave, all my life. So life is extremely involved in Rothko's paintings, even though to look at them, there's no real clue. Also, even for that matter, the fact that they're symmetrical brings in the whole religious tradition, because religious art is generally very symmetrical.
So, yeah, I had this question here about Greenberg, which was the critic who kind of advocated purity in painting and monochromatic paintings and color form paintings. And he was saying that, by basically leaving painterliness behind completely and just going with these pure canvases that are lightly stained red or blue or what have you, that this was a way to get to the pure kind of spiritual feeling in the artist. But what you're talking about with Mark Rothko seems to me to say, you have to bring the world in, that the world will come in. And maybe in his case, it worked to be symmetrical and to have almost a monochromatic approach sometimes, but that was because of what he was actually representing. Do you think that the cosmic or the transcendent or the interiorized can be represented without that mundane realm of history, or do you think it always has to be there?
Well, I just think it's impossible to leave the world behind. We live in the world, we're surrounded by things, which you've been writing about. And there's a sense in which we're encumbered by a world that we can't escape. So Greenberg's attempts at pure painting, that actually drawing was out, a line was out, subject, realistic subject matter was out, or even references to that. And so on, he had this list of prescriptions. And actually, I don't think more than just a handful of people followed that. And he died, Greenberg, finally, as a man who had tried to start a movement that had never really happened. I think he had as much trouble controlling abstract painting as Breton did trying to control the surrealists politically.
So, yeah, the only one I can think of is Barnett Newman's red paintings that seem to be pure kind of color form, but I don't know. Maybe I'm knocking him unfairly. I don't really know his
work. By using these simple lines, which he called zips, against an active field, and playing with symmetry and asymmetry and so forth, he's still somebody that you look at as either deriving in some funny way from Mondrian, who was, I think, deeply spiritual. And I don't see, well, the weird thing about Barnett Newman, of course, is his famous remark where he said that aesthetics is for the artists like ornithology is for the birds. And I think he'll be remembered for that as much as by the painting.
I want to ask you about your paintings, and then because I think it's a way to move into the UFO subject. You're an abstract expressionist, but as you progressed, you started using more geometric abstraction in your Guardian paintings. And when I looked at them and then started flipping through my book here on my shelf, The Shock of the New, I was struck by how the Guardian paintings reminded me of these Russian paintings, the suprematist paintings. Were you aware of that connection at the time? Am I wrong to see a connection between them?
No, that's an accurate thing. I don't really feel influenced by the suprematists and Malevich and so on, although I really admire especially Malevich's work. But it's much more important to me was Mondrian, who was, of course, on a slightly separate track from Malevich, and I think a far greater painter. I think Malevich is a terrific artist of maybe the second rank, or however you want to score things. But Mondrian is the with this absolutely pure white surfaces, the black lines here and there, crossing at right angles, and just the primary colors here and there in rectangles. I mean, when you look at them, this is one of the first painters that absolutely knocked me out. I feel a sort of a debt to Mondrian and an enormous admiration, but I think that they're incredibly spiritual paintings, even though the forms might look like they connect with architecture. I think they go beyond that.
See, I think his work has been somewhat polluted in the public mind because it's ended up in so many different places, Mondrian's work. You know, like, when I think of his work, I think of a swatch. You know what a swatch is? It was, like, in the 80s, a popular kind of plastic watch.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, it's everything. You can find them on cocktail napkins, I suppose.
Right, but, yeah.
I would imagine that in religious circles there's still representations of Jesus' face and cocktail napkins, too. I don't know about that, but I'll make a guess.
So was there a connection there between what the suprematists were doing and what Mondrian was doing?
I think there is. I'm a little cloudy on the connections. I don't think either one was really aware of the other when they began moving in the direction they moved into, but...
You know, the Russians wanted, I read a little bit about them, they were trying to get pure feeling onto the canvas and using pure geometric forms to do that. But there was also this political edge to it because, you know, it was pure geometric forms, but it happened to be a black square and a red square.
Right? Yeah.
It was definitely a combination of the spiritual feeling and a revolutionary ambition in Russia around the time of the revolution. I would imagine that revolutionary ambition might not have been as present in Mondrian, but
no, I think that's true. I think he was completely involved with painting, and as it could be manipulated, you know, purely without reference to anything, including anything political. I can't imagine that he was a political artist in any way. He's really a kind of an ascetic. He's a monk living in this sort of perfect world that he's trying to construct. And the idea of beauty and purity and order, which was so important to him, I think had a very strong spiritual edge to it, but not a political one.
Well, describe the spiritual edge and the what you were doing with your own Guardian paintings.
Well, that's where it gets more complicated because I was pursuing the abstract expressionist impulse in its purest sense. The early years, as far as I was concerned, was the kind of loose, free, kind of maybe wild painting that was being done by Franz Klein and Bill de Kooning and Pollock and so forth. And that's where I started. And I was extremely involved with that. But somehow I kept feeling I needed more order. And I was moving towards contrasting hard-edged ordered forms with this loose thing. So it was a combination kind of you might say, printing and painting together in the same work, or architecture and nature in the same work. And so I had these two poles in my work. And as I moved along and began, it's too long, complicated thing, and I want to explain how I got involved in finally inventing these guardian images, which had a sense of being a figure, but which in which I abandoned for the first time any presence of the loose painting that had been an element of contrast in all the earlier work. So there I was doing these very rigorous, abstract, hard-edged paintings, but then I began to, but then I was making them as a sort of complex and emotional and energetic in terms of color and their silhouettes. So I got the abstract expressionist violence and speed and energy and so on in that. But then I began making sculptures out of old ancient wood that I was finding. All the wood had to be really old and grubby. And I began making altars out of that to go with the guardians and the temples. And I even had a show once in Soho where I just simply put the wood sculptures, which were made to very simply, but to look like altars of some vanished religion or vanished culture. I juxtapose those with these hard-edged, very modernist paintings, because I felt I needed both. So here I am straddling as a true collage aesthetic type, two different emotional worlds.
I'm here to let you know it's not hard to make a collage. It's really easy. Basically, anything that you can glue down becomes a collage.
When we drive our motor cars, we have a right to expect the best in comfort, safety, durability, performance, appearance, and economy at all times.
That's what I want.
These are things we want to keep for life.
Picasso and George Braque started collage, and it's basically comes from a French word meaning glue. So let's get started and look at some of the things we can glue down.
This is the first car I ever owned. I call her Cynthia. She's going to have the best car a car ever has. Put Royal Triton in Cynthia's little tummy.
Right, ready? Oh, you feel the breeze from the subway? This is delicious.
Sort of cools the ankles, doesn't it? Well, what do you think would be fun to do now?
So, we're working on the composition now, trying to pick out different pieces. I'm going for kind of a travel theme, so I picked this map.
The process of seeing paintings or seeing anything else is less spontaneous and natural than we tend to believe. A large part of seeing depends upon habit and invention. All the paintings of the tradition used the invention of perspective.
It's not hard to make a collage. It's really easy.
In the original abstract expressionist approach with Jackson Pollock's gesture, that kind of improvisation on the canvas, what's being aimed at is a feeling, a purity of feeling, as maybe something spiritual, something from inside the painter that you can't get in a more formal way, right? But at the same time, this very structured approach with geometric shapes also aims at that same feeling that both of them are beyond representation, right?
Yeah, well, right. Except, well, of course, it was a movement that included the poles, so to speak, and everything in between. But I think that the when you refer to Pollock's thing as being spiritual, it's and de Kooning and Klein. I think they would have felt sort of uncomfortable with that word spiritual, but I do think that they were extremely involved in just an idea of achieving beauty by a new way. But the beauty, in a strange way, had to be connected with a sort of looseness and violence. A lot of people have talked about the fact that abstract expressions came about really at the time of the early Cold War and the kind of worries and fears that everybody had about the bomb and the nervousness, the angst. And I think that that was present in those paintings, which is not exactly something I'd call spiritual, something different, but
right.
You know, these terms are a little hard to toss around.
Yeah, I know. It's not complete at all. I mean, to say spiritual also has its own set of baggage, right? I'm not trying to refer to necessarily even something that's beyond the material necessarily, right? But well, I could keep going down this road. Like, the next thing I want to ask you about is now the guy's name is escaping me, which is on the road, Jack Kerouac, and jazz, and you had an encounter with Jack Kerouac. Well, now that I've said his name, I have to let you tell this story. But Jack Kerouac was a deeply spiritual guy, but who loved jazz, right? And I see like a connection between abstract expressionism and its gesture and jazz, and there's something in both that maybe a guy like Kerouac, as kind of a mixed up bum as he was, would have seen and appreciated.
Yeah, he was particularly drawn to Klein.
Was he?
Yep, he used to hang around his studio. You know.
Yeah. Well, tell the story about your encounter with Jack Kerouac.
It's sort of a sad little story, but I was a very young painter and had gotten married, and my wife, Joan, was, she was probably at the time of this incident, she was probably about 20. And we went to a party, and I'm trying to remember the name of the man whose party it was. He was a sort of crossover jazz classical musician, played the French horn, a very nice guy. But at any rate, we went there to the party, and Kerouac was very drunk and carrying on. And at some point, I went upstairs to another room to use a john or some whatever it was, get a drink. And when I came back, he had Joan sort of backed against the wall, and his arm, I think, was up. His arms were sort of up, leaning against the wall, so he was inches away. And he's coming on with her very strongly, and I was at that point pretty pissed. So I went over and said, you know, this is my wife, and because she looked kind of scared. And then he sort of blew up like. Who the hell was I? And, you know, because the sense of entitlement, because the book was a big hit and everything, and he was drunk and this was his situation. So he started after me, and I took Joan, and the host came over and sort of broke up, pulled Kerouac away, and I got out with Joan, okay. But they left me with, let's say, not exactly a pleasant taste. The beats were, some of them were hanging around the Cedar Bar and the painters, but the painters just didn't really take to them because the beats managed to make the abstract expressionists, the guys and women, seem like people who were punching the clock and selling works to the bourgeoisie and so forth, and they had a different attitude.
Right. Yeah, the Beats were the real rebels, and you guys were, you know, the gray men in suits or something.
Oh, yeah, I think they were, thought we were only a couple of inches away from bourgeoisdom, you know.
If I had a big enough cannon, I would shoot myself to the moon in such a way that I'd get stuck in orbit and wouldn't come down soon. I'd just keep going round in circles, and every lunar sunrise would be a brand new day for me. I'd see it with a fresh pair of eyes. Don't rescue me from absolute isolation, please. Don't disturb me or interrupt my imagination. I am revolving, revolving around the moon, and I'm not gonna come down anytime soon.
Modernism and the collage aesthetic. Picasso, sometime near the end of 1911, created a small oval work, a cubist still life, that is generally regarded as art history's first collage. Across more than one-third of its surface, Picasso glued a piece of commercial oilcloth bearing a photographically reproduced image of a chair cleaning. On the remainder of the canvas, he painted a cubist still life, an image which is itself highly ambiguous.
Now, when I was in Australia a number of years ago giving some talks, I was in Brisbane, and this couple had come up afterwards, said, you know, we had something happen last week, including our son was there with us, and we all three woke up at the same hour bleeding from the right nostril, and this really, really upset them.
In this small seminal work, the war between photography and painting as representational modes is both stated baldly and, through a series of subtle formal decisions, tentatively resolved.
But this woman said, well, have you ever seen anything like this? And she hands me three pictures, this being the first one. May I have the next one? The next one? We'll wait for a moment here. She handed me these three. And she said, have you seen anything like this? And I assumed it had to do with the red color, and I said no. She said that, I asked if it was color film. She said it was all color film. These pictures are kind of in the middle of the roll, and they were the only red ones, and everything else was normal.
But the issue I want to emphasize here concerns collage not as a physical technique, a marriage of contrasting materials, but rather as a philosophical attitude, an aesthetic position, that can suffuse virtually any expressive medium.
And I said, well, I've never seen this before, not knowing really what to make of even the question. And she said, but that's not the problem, the redness. She said, the problem is we're supposed to be in that picture and we're not. And in all three pictures, may we see the next one too? I mean, you wouldn't even take a picture like that if there aren't people standing in the foreground.
Pluralistic world in which we deal with infinitely more information, more contradictory social roles, more diverse realities than in any previous century. The smooth, continuous, unruffled space of older representational art is not appropriate to the disjunctions of our typical life experience. Consciously or unconsciously, contemporary artists work to create harmony from distinctly jarring material, forcing warring ideas, materials, and spatial systems into a tense and perhaps arbitrary thought.
He's taking the picture, and all of a sudden he says, you know, they're going up and with great panic, and he said, they don't even look surprised. As if the expressions and the posture and everything is just frozen, up they go. And he's holding the camera, and so I did a few of my false leads that I will do, in a case like that. I said, I imagine you turn to the people in the playground and cry for help.
Our minds and the very texture of our worldly experience enable us to find unity within observed disparity. The collage aesthetic, like earlier aesthetic systems, has no objective moral or emotional content. Intrinsically, it is neither inferior or superior to any other. It simply describes the way we've come to view the world.
Deze voicemailbox accepteert geen berichten. Dank u voor uw oproep. Tot ziens.
Congratulations, Doug. The one-year milestone is a mark that many podcasters never make it to, as their ambition wanes faster than a New Year's resolution of going to the gym. Lorenzo, of the Psychedelic Salon, has often said that 100 episodes is his litmus test for loquacious luminaries to find the pulse of their podcast and hit their stride. The quality of your Diet Soap podcast, both in terms of audio awesomeness and conversational content, has steadily risen as your episode count climbed. The podcast happily went from occasional oddity that I explored to a regular part of my multimedia menu. All the while I wondered, what's up with the mixtape switching soundbite between segments? For those new soapsters looking to sample the best of the Diet Soap scene, three of my favorite episodes from the first 52 that I would recommend are Episode 39 with Chris Carlson, author of Nowtopia, How Pirate Programmers, Outlaw Bicyclists, and Vacant Lot Gardeners Are Inventing the Future Today. Episode 30, A New Logic, in which Doug and Sea Realm podcast host KMO explore new modes of civilization that are characterized by sustainability and global well-being. And the recent Episode 51, Hope and Faith Are Good for Walking, with guest author Robert Jensen. In your most recent episode, you explored whether Kevin Dole's suggestion that the philosophical territories of Neil Kramer, James Howard Kunstler, KMO, and yourself represented outliers of pseudo-enlightenment. That made me wonder, who would fill the center of that conceptual compass? I believe it should be someone with enough optimism for a better tomorrow to face the dystopic dieback dilemmas of Kunstler, the technological singularity temptations of KMO, or the conspiratorial considerations of Kramer. Someone who could represent a form of optimistic higher ground to the perspectives that the other hosts often act as harbor to. Perhaps Jarrett Sanchez and his Next Step podcast? Whoever or whatever podcast should happen to fill the center of that conceptual compass, I hope that everyone maintains some optimism for the future of humanity.
Well, that just about wraps up the 53rd episode of the Diet Soap podcast, and I feel that year two has started well. Bud Hopkins will be back next week, and we'll delve into the material for which he may be more widely known, and continue to discuss his book, Art, Life, and UFOs. I'll point out now that you heard Box Air on a G-string and George Machuna's Piano Number 13 in that last collage on the collage aesthetic. That was a prepared piano piece, that Piano Number 13, performed in this case by the band members of Sonic Youth. You probably noticed that Machuna's piece was performed with hammers and nails on a piano keyboard. The Flying Lizards cover of Barrett Strong's Money, That's What I Want, also featured a prepared piano. And you heard O Come Emmanuel on a prepared piano. That was performed by the YouTube star Naderfend, and it was layered on top of the Flying Lizard cover in the second collage. And at the very beginning, you heard T.S. Eliot himself reading from The Wasteland, while Tim Ovens performed John Cage's Sonata X for, what else? Prepared piano. I want to thank Jamie O for calling in and leaving a voicemail at the Diet Soap Hotline. The number to call is 971-285-4604. That's 971-285-4604, and you can call to get your voice onto Diet Soap. I said at the outset that I'd explain more about the Kickstarter project at the end of the episode, but instead of going on and on asking for pledges, I'll just let you know that a link to the proposal will be in the show notes and remind you that I plan on reaching out to pre-existing organizations such as the Portland Fruit Project, Urban Gleaners, Growing Gardens, and others, as I organize with neighbors to map out and harvest my immediate environment, and that I'll start over on that radical self-help book you heard in episode 34. Rather than cutting my life to pieces, I want to pick my battle. Again, it was terrific talking to Bud Hopkins about his book, Art, Life, and UFOs, and you'll hear more about that book and the UFO side of his life next week. All that's left this week is another Titanic factoid from my lovely wife, Miriam.
History is most interesting when you can engage with some personal histories and primary sources. So I thought that perhaps I would share some such things regarding the Titanic and people who were associated with it. So I have found for today a letter written by second-class passenger Harvey Collier to his parents in Surrey. He was traveling with his wife Charlotte and his daughter Marjorie. They were emigrating to America to buy a fruit farm, but also because there was supposed to be a better climate for young Charlotte who had consumption. They'd been living in Bishopstoke, Hampshire, where Harvey ran a grocery store, and the letter is written from the Titanic, April 11th. My dear Mum and Dad, it don't seem possible we are out on the briny writing to you. Well, dears, so far we are having a delightful trip. The weather is beautiful and the ship magnificent. We can't describe the tables. It's like a floating town. I can tell you we do swank. We shall miss it on the trains as we go third on them. You would not imagine you were on a ship. There is hardly any motion. She is so large. We have not felt sick, yet we expect to get to Queenstown today, so thought I would drop this with the mails. We had a fine send-off from Southampton, and Mrs. S. and the boys with others saw us off. We will post again at New York, then when we get to pay it. Lots of love, don't worry about us. Ever your loving children, Harvey and Lot and Madge.